Good evening, everyone. Perhaps a few more will trickle in. I know we've just come from dinner, so some might be slow. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's keynote lecture for the Coming Back to Life, Performance, Memory, and Cognition in the Ancient Mediterranean Conference. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the conference organizers here, myself, Fred Tappenden, Ellen Aitken, Dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies, Carly Daniel Hughes, Professor of Early Christianity at Concordia. We're thrilled that you can all be here. I'd especially like to welcome those who are here from the CAC and from the AAH, the Classical Association of Canada, and the Association of Ancient Historians, who are having meetings right now at the same time. We're happy to have you here with us. Some brief information about the conference that we're running at the same time as these other ones. We are basically running a small research workshop or colloquium that explores the different ways that the lines between death and life were neither fixed nor finite in the ancient Mediterranean. We recognize that for most people, death was a passageway into a new and an uncertain mode of existence. The dead were not really extinguished as they were elsewhere, that they could continue to affect the living in certain ways. They could continue to impress themselves on the living in certain ways. So this is the topic of our Coming Back to Life, Performance, Memory, and Cognition conference. Our four-day research event has brought together classicists, scholars of early Christianity, scholars of early Judaism, scholars of ancient religion, material culture, all with the hopes of exploring different facets of this topic. Before we introduce the keynote, I'd like to thank our sponsors, in particular the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. They've graciously given us a grant to host this event, and we want to acknowledge them. The Concordia Office of the VP Research and Graduate Studies has also given us a research grant to host this event. The McGill Faculty of Religious Studies, where we are all sitting this evening in this beautiful chapel. The Concordia Department of Religion and the McGill Center for Research on Religion. We thank these organizations for their support. Carly, would you come and introduce our speaker?
So, it is my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for this evening. Sarah Iles Johnston comes to us from the Department of Classics at Ohio State University. In 2011, she was named the Arts and Humanities Distinguished Professor of Religion, which we learned last night makes her the first named professor of religion at The Ohio State University. Prior to her appointment at Ohio State, she lectured in classics both at Princeton University and Cornell, where she received MA and PhD. Professor Johnston is the author of many books, and I'll just highlight a few of them for you to whet your interest. Restless Dead, Encounters Between the Living and the Dead in Ancient Greece, University of California Press, 1999, co-authored with Fritz Graf, Ritual Texts for the Afterlife, Orpheus and the Bacchic Gold Tablets, Routledge 2007, with a second edition in 2013, and Ancient Greek Divination, Wiley-Blackwell, 2008. Without further ado, I give you Sarah Johnston. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carly, and thanks to all the organizers. I'm keenly aware of how much effort goes into organizing a conference. A four-day conference takes 2 years to organize, and I appreciate the fact that you've done it, and you've done it so well, and with such interesting stuff for us to listen to. Although, as you may have been able to tell from Carly's introduction, I've spent most of my career writing about death. There has always been one question that interested me deeply, but that I never had the occasion to pursue until now. This conference was perfect, in fact. Namely, the question of how the Greeks envisioned a return from death and what happens to the soul who tries to return. I'd spent a lot of my previous career, in other words, working on how do you get to the land of the dead in Greece, how do you optimize your choices once you're there, etc. But I had never had a chance to really put my thoughts together on going the opposite way. Now, of course, that's too large a topic for any single lecture, and so I've decided to focus tonight on just one aspect of it. I'll be looking at myths that the Greeks told about returning from death. And I mean by that myths in contrast, for example, to the medical literature, which sometimes considered this question. I'll be asking why the Greeks were willing to entertain in their myths certain variations of the idea of returning from death, but not entertain others. In the end, I'll use the answers to those questions to try to say something larger about the Greek conceptualization of the self. I'll proceed like this. First, I'll remind you of some basic Greek ideas about the transition from life to death. With this as background, I'll next relate some myths about returns from death and draw some initial conclusions about them. Then, for comparative purposes, I'll leap forward into the 20th and 21st centuries and take you through a few of the many representations of returning from the dead that Western culture has produced and draw some tentative conclusions about those. I'll then leap backwards to the medieval period. Examining some beliefs about the dead from this period will finally enable me to make some suggestions about why we, in the 21st century, seem to be so obsessed with one idea about the returning dead with which the Greeks were not. This, finally, will allow me to reach at least some tentative conclusions about ancient Greek ideas themselves. I have to add a comment here that in the time I've been at this conference, I've already realized that my knowledge of late antique and medieval Christianity is perhaps not all that it should be. So I'm going to spin that both negatively and positively. For me, it's a huge positive because you will be able to correct me where I have gone astray. Of course, for you guys, it might be a negative, and I hope I do not make too egregious mistakes. So first, let's review some basic Greek ideas about the transition from life to death. For the Greeks, as for most other peoples, there is an actual place to which one goes when one dies, namely the underworld. This looked pretty much like the upper world, with trees, rocks, roads, and meadows, but there was a barrier that firmly separated the two, a river across which each newly arrived soul had to be ferried by a boatman named Charon. Charon expected to be paid for his labors. No fare meant no passage for the soul, and an eternity spent wandering on the river's banks, unable to rest among either the living or the dead. To avoid this, your family had to bury you properly, which from at least the Hellenistic time meant burying you with a coin with which you could pay Charon. Geography and commerce reiterated ontological categories, in other words. You were either alive or dead, with your fare paid across the river or not, and anything in between was very unpleasant. The river was not the only barrier. Once you got to the gates of Hades' palace, the three-headed dog Cerberus stopped you from entering unless you were really dead. In and of himself, then, Cerberus reiterates the separation between the worlds of the living and the dead. But interestingly, Cerberus appears in myths far more often as a captured or overwhelmed victim than he does as a successful enforcer of the boundary. Here, we see him being pulled into the upper world by Heracles, the most common context in which we find him in ancient literature and art. It's almost as if Cerberus had been created specifically for the purpose of being conquered. Or to put it otherwise, Cerberus's appearances in myths tacitly prompt the question of, what if? What if you could enter the underworld and return again? How would you do it? Charon can prompt these questions as well. After all, Heracles and the other heroes who journey to the underworld while still alive have to convince him to row them across the river both ways. And in another myth, Charon is completely outfoxed by one of the living, namely Sisyphus. Sisyphus first escapes from death literally by chaining him up. I'll return to that part of the story in a moment. And then after death has been released from the chains and is about to capture Sisyphus, Sisyphus instructs his wife not to give his body proper burial, which includes not burying it with the coin to pay Charon. When Sisyphus is duly denied passage across the river, he complains to Persephone about his wife's apparent neglect until Persephone allows him to return to life long enough to address the problem. Of course, once Sisyphus is back in the upper world, he decides to stay. Eventually, he dies of old age, and once again in the underworld, is placed among the great transgressors of Greek myth, where he is condemned to roll a rock uphill forever. This double, albeit temporary, escape from death in the myth of Sisyphus, again raises questions. How might we evade what seems inevitable? And what will be the final result if we do? It wasn't only the great transgressors who had reason to fear what followed death, however. Anyone could end up in dire straits simply by having died at the wrong time or in the wrong way. Those who died violently, by being murdered, for example, those whose bodies were left improperly buried, as in the case of Sisyphus, and those who died too young, for women this meant dying before marriage and childbirth, all these types of souls were doomed to wander forever between the upper and lower worlds, unless the living intervened and somehow fixed the problem. In the case of a murder victim, this meant avenging the murder. In the case of the unburied, this meant performing burial rites. In the case of those who died too young, there was not really much that one could do to get the wanderer admitted to the land of the dead, but one could perform rituals to appease or avert such a ghost, lest it harm the living. And in fact, such ghosts could do a lot of harm. Because these souls were restless, they were unhappy. Typically, they sought to injure those who were responsible for their plight, those who had murdered them or those who left their bodies unburied, or to injure those whom they envied. In the case of the souls of women who had died too early, such envy led to their causing other virgins, pregnant women, and infants to die. Although many cities had annual rituals that were intended to appease such souls, there was always the possibility that one was being overlooked. Danger was always present. And as if these unhappily dead souls didn't cause enough trouble on their own, they were also shanghaied into service by magicians, who forced them to perform all kinds of dastardly deeds as well. The restless dead were easier for magicians to compel because they were restless, trapped between worlds. Not all souls of the dead were angry and envious, however. Indeed, some souls freely gave their aid to the living, particularly their descendants, warding off illnesses and enhancing women's fecundity. Hero cults are the most formalized version of this idea. Like the figures who formally marked the separation between the upper and lower worlds, all of these returning ghosts, be they threatening or helpful, played on the idea that the boundary between life and death was permeable to some degree. Although they were dead, they nonetheless were still able to interact with the living. I want to emphasize, however, that this interaction, whether it be positive or negative, was never imagined to be of a tangible sort, requiring that the dead have a physical body. Rather, the dead we've talked about so far returned as psukai alone, as ghosts. Indeed, their lack of physicality is underscored by a number of ritual texts indicating that in order to control such a ghost, you might have to create a statue, that is, an artificial body, somehow attach the statue to the ghost ritually, and then either abandon the statue in an unfrequented place, as is dictated in a sacred law from Cyrene, for example, or bind the statue, thus restricting the movements of the ghost, as was done to the ghost of Actaeon, according to Pausanias. Did Greek myth ever picture anyone as completely returning to life, both body and soul? Was it possible for an individual to resume a tangible existence in the upper world? Occasionally, yes. I've been able to find 6 myths that engage with that possibility, or maybe 7 or 8, depending on how you view a certain matter that I'll get to in a moment. Let's start by returning to Sisyphus. As I said, he first managed to chain death up, and then after death had been released and duly claimed him, Sisyphus managed to find a clever way to exploit the existential difficulties of the restless dead and return again to the upper world. Now, while he was chained up, not only was death unable to snatch Sisyphus, but he was also unable to snatch anyone else. No one could die, as our oldest source for the story, Pherakleides of Athens, tells us. Also, according to Pherakleides, the god who decided to remedy the situation was Ares, which at first glance seems like a rather odd choice, given that Ares scarcely appears elsewhere in Greek myths, and that Ares is not a particularly clever god, the kind whom we would expect to be able to disentangle chains that were complex enough to constrain death. That sounds more like a job for Hermes, or maybe Hephaestus. Pherakleides' story as we have it, it comes down to us only as a resume embedded in a scholium to Homer, doesn't explain why Ares got involved, but perhaps it's fair to say that if any god had a personal stake in the matter, it would have been him. The few places in literature where we do find Ares, such as battle scenes in the Iliad, portray him as a bloodthirsty god who takes grim delight in fatalities. In other words, we might guess that Sisyphus's capture of death took away Ares' source of pleasure, and that Ares wanted it back. But at any rate, the story as we have it does indicate that the only reason the divine world got involved in the tussle between Sisyphus and death was that one of the gods had a personal stake in the matter. Even more famous than Sisyphus's return to life was that attempted by Orpheus, who traveled to the underworld to recover his wife, who had died on their wedding day. Orpheus used his remarkable talents as a musician to persuade Persephone to allow him to lead her back to the upper world. Here we see him singing just outside the palace of Persephone in Hades, alongside indeed Sisyphus, Heracles, and other famous denizens of the underworld. Although there may have been an early version of the story in which Orpheus succeeded at this task, in all the versions that remain to us, he failed. His wife slipped away from him at the last moment because he violated Persephone's stipulation that he not look back at her until they reached the upper world. Orpheus, plunged into a deeper grief than before by this second loss of his wife, refused to remarry. Eventually, he was murdered by a group of women whose attentions he spurned. The general pattern behind Orpheus's story is also found in that of Protesilaus and his wife Laodamia. After only one day of marriage, Protesilaus joined the Greek expedition to Troy and was killed by Hector as soon as he leapt off the ship. The gods took pity on the despairing Laodamia and allowed Protesilaus to return to the upper world for a single day in order to bid her farewell. Upon her husband's second death, however, Laodamia, like Orpheus, plunged into even greater despair, which drove her to commission a statue of her husband that she could take to bed with her, an interesting variation on the uses of statues to instantiate ghosts that I mentioned a moment ago. Upon discovering what she was doing at night, Laodamia's father had the image destroyed, and Laodamia killed herself. In these last two stories, the return to life is represented as a favor that the gods can freely bestow upon mortals when they choose to do so. The more general idea that control over death is in the hands of the gods lies behind both parts of the story of Sisyphus, too. During the time that he had death chained up, no one on Olympus seems to have worried about the fact that mortals were not dying, except for one god who had a personal interest in the matter. And when Sisyphus himself later died, it was Persephone's approval that enabled him to return to life. Whether a particular mortal lives or dies, and whether he or she remains dead or returns to life, are represented in Greek myths as being matters of divine inclination and are to be decided on a case-to-case basis. Now, that may sound like a rather obvious statement, but it's important because the Greeks could, when they chose, take a different view and present human affairs as relying completely on fate. In the Iliad, for example, we several times hear that a warrior is fated to die on a certain day, and he duly does so in spite not only of his own attempts to evade death, but in spite of any god's desires to save him as well. Sarpedon is the most familiar example of this. His father Zeus wanted to save him, but Hera reminded Zeus that to do so would overturn the dictates of fate, and Zeus reluctantly agreed not to interfere. The myths that I've just been discussing are not interested in this fate-based worldview. They don't necessarily contradict it. After all, one could always reason that fate intended Sisyphus to live to an old age. But that would be to put words in the mouths of the myths. It's not what they're interested in talking about. They prefer to entertain the idea that such decisions lie on the knees of the gods. And this is the case with my next myth as well, concerning the twins Castor and Polydeuces. Or rather, we should say half-twins, for the two shared a mother, but Castor was sired by a mortal man and Polydeuces was sired by Zeus. Castor, therefore, was mortal and Polydeuces immortal. When Castor died, Polydeuces asked Zeus to restore him to life. Zeus made them a deal. Each of the brothers would be dead half the time and alive half the time. Depending on the version of the story you read, either Castor or Polydeuces spent one day together in Hades and the next day together alive, or they traded off. Polydeuces was above while Castor was below, and Castor was above while Polydeuces was below. However we settle that, the story of Castor and Polydeuces again presents a situation in which a member of the dead returns to life at the request of a loved one through the intervention of a god. My next case takes us in a different direction. Asclepius, a talented physician, eventually honed his skills to the point that he could raise the dead, and did so on several occasions. Zeus put a stop to this by striking Asclepius with a lightning bolt. In most versions of the story, no reason is given for Zeus's action. But according to Diodorus Siculus, Hades asked Zeus to do it because the lower world was short on citizens. Here, for the first time in our case studies, we have a mortal succeeding at what only gods otherwise do, raising the dead. That Asclepius was a physician, of course, makes a certain sense. I'll come back to that later. Note, too, that as in the story of Sisyphus, it is the gods who put death back into business for reasons of their own, and that as in the cases of Orpheus and Laodamia, the mortal who seeks to reverse death ends up the worse off for it himself. The aftermath of Asclepius' death brings me to my sixth and perhaps last case. Asclepius' father, Apollo, was grief-stricken when his son died. Apollo lashed out and killed the indirect agents of that death, the Cyclopes who had forged the lightning bolt that Zeus used. To punish Apollo for this transgression, Zeus condemned him to serve Admetus, the king of Thessaly, for a year. The god and his mortal master became friends, and when the fates decreed that it was Admetus' time to die, Apollo intervened and got the fates to agree that if someone else volunteered to die in place of Admetus, Admetus would be spared. Note that here again, we see the intervention of a god in matters of life and death, and again for purely personal reasons. Now, Apollo thought it would be easy to find a volunteer. In particular, he assumed that either of Admetus' aged parents would be happy to step in, but they declined, as did everyone else who was asked. And then before Admetus could stop her, the one person who hadn't been asked, his wife Alcestis, volunteered to take her husband's place. Admetus was horrified, but the promise could not be retracted, and so Alcestis died. On the day of the funeral, Heracles dropped in for a visit. Loath to burden his friend with his grief, Admetus hid Alcestis' death from Heracles, who proceeded to eat, drink, and make merry. After Heracles was drunk, a servant slipped and revealed that Alcestis' funeral had just been held. Heracles set out for the cemetery, confronted death as he came to claim Alcestis, and beat death in a wrestling match. Heracles led Alcestis, intact, back to her husband. As in the second part of Sisyphus' story, victory was complete. Alcestis and Admetus lived on to ripe old ages. As in the first part of Sisyphus' story, death was conquered by a mortal using physical means, although there is also a version of Alcestis' story in Plato, according to which either Persephone or the gods as a group, admiring Alcestis' courage, decided to send her back to the world of the living, which aligns with some of the other cases we've looked at in which the gods choose which mortals merit their return to life. I mentioned that there were possibly two more cases of the dead returning to life, depending on how you look at things. I mean, first of all, Semele, who spontaneously combusted when Zeus revealed himself to her in all of his divine glory. As she burned, Zeus rescued from her womb their child, Dionysus, who, after he grew up, journeyed to the underworld and convinced Hades and Persephone to release Semele's soul. That having been done, Dionysus led his mother all the way up, not only to the world of the living, but to the heavens, where she joined the company of the gods. This might be understood as another instance of return from death to life. Semele's destination, however, not Earth, but rather Olympus, does ring a change on the pattern. After all, she does not resume her normal embodied life, but rather becomes a goddess. We can talk about that later if you wish, but for now I'll simply note that as in several of the other myths we looked at, It was divine intervention, in this case Dionysus, that did the trick. A parallel case, which you heard about yesterday from Katerina, is that of Hippolytus. Again, he dies. He returns not to normal mortal life, but to, call him a god, call him a hero, it's some sort of divinized life. Let me sum up some of the things that we can take away from these stories. First, we can divide them into three types. Those in which the return of the dead is wholly successful. Those in which the return of the dead is successful, but those who initiate it are punished by the gods. And those in which the dead fail to return, and it is the failure itself that has dire consequences for those who initiate it. Our remaining case, Castor, probably belongs to the first category. Although we might argue that the return of Castor had dire consequences for Polydeuces insofar as he loses half of his immortality, the myth does not present the situation that way. Second, none of these three story types implies that returning from the dead is in and of itself a problem. It's usually presented in these myths as a special dispensation that a god might bestow or that a particularly clever mortal might devise for himself. And third, the returning dead themselves are not presented as problems in these stories. The problems, when there are problems, arise either from angering a god, which results from having evaded death without the complicity of the gods themselves, as in the cases of Asclepius and Sisyphus, or from having failed to accept limitations set by the gods, as in the case of Orpheus and of Laodamia. If the Greeks feared the return of the dead in and of itself, it was the return of the dead in the form of those restless disembodied souls that I mentioned earlier, or in other words, again, ghosts, not the possibility of the dead returning in the body. The stories told about the return of the dead in the modern West are quite different. In 1902, W.W. Jacobs published a short story called The Monkey's Paw. The title refers to a mummified monkey's paw that a soldier has brought home from India, a talisman that can grant its owner three wishes. Having experienced its dangerous powers himself and wishing to destroy it, the soldier nonetheless reluctantly gives it to his friends. Their initial wish is for £200 to pay off their mortgage. The next day, their son is killed in a horrible factory accident. The compensation for his death is exactly £200. 10 more days go by, and the mother, overwhelmed by grief, snatches up the paw and makes a second wish, that her son will come home. Immediately, there comes a knocking at the door. As the mother joyously fumbles to open it, the father, who had been the one to identify his son's badly mutilated body at the morgue, picks up the claw and quickly makes a wish of his own. When the door swings open, there is nothing there but the wind whistling through the empty street. The point of the story is well expressed by what the soldier says when he first shows the paw to his friends. It had a spell put on it by an old fakir, a very holy man. He wanted it to show that fate ruled people's lives and that those who interfered with it did so to their sorrow. The Monkey's Paw was an enormous success as soon as it was published. A year after publication, it was adapted for the London stage, and there have been many radio, film, and TV versions as well. Stephen King uses the idea that underlies it in several of his novels, most prominently Pet Sematary, a novel in which a young doctor uses the power of an ancient Indian burial ground to resurrect first his daughter's cat and then his 2-year-old son. As in all tales of the monkey's paw type, the doctor learns to his regret that, as another character had warned him, sometimes dead is better. In Pet Sematary, those who return, be they animal or human, are gruesomely marked by the ways in which they died, carry a lingering stench of the grave, and also, far more alarmingly, harbor a vicious spirit called the Wendigo. Although the body that returns may be that of a cat or a child, the soul and intelligence that animate it are purely evil. Similarly, in C.S. Lewis's 1945 novel, That Hideous Strength, A team of scientists who are bent on taking over first Britain and then the world think they have reanimated the head of a recently executed convict, a brilliant but criminally insane man who they believe will lead them in their endeavors. Bad as that sounds, it gets worse. As it turns out, the head is no longer inhabited by the soul and mind of the convict. It's been possessed by a force of evil that has its own colonizing plans, which extend to the entire universe. In Solaris, a 1961 novel by Stanislaw Lem, which has been made into a movie 3 times, a team of scientists sent to investigate a distant planet are apparently visited by loved ones they left behind on Earth, including for the main character Chris, his dead wife, Rhea, who committed suicide after Chris told her he was leaving. Rhea, who says that she still loves Chris, is willing to let bygones be bygones and resume their marriage. Although drawn to her by a combination of guilt and desire, Chris is more alert to danger than are the protagonists in other monkey's paw type stories and initially resists temptation. Indeed, he lures Rhea into a shuttlecraft that he launches into outer space. Yet when he awakens the next day, she seems to have again returned from death. The original novel and 2 of the film versions end with Rhea helping the scientists find a way to end her new existence, which has become as unhappy as her first life was. The end of the 3rd and most recent film is ambiguous. We could understand Chris as choosing to stay with the new Rhea, although in an altered bodily state himself. In any case, all versions of the story bring us up against the central issue of the monkey's paw and ask us to consider once again whether staying dead might be better, better for those who died and also for those who were left behind. I could go on at great length with this catalog of 20th century stories that posit the bodily return of the dead and the disasters that follow. An entire lecture could be devoted to H.P. Lovecraft's treatments of the idea, and particularly his stories of Herbert West, Reanimator, in which a young medical student's attempts to reanimate the dead prompt decaying corpses or parts of corpses to violently attack the living. That, in turn, would lead us back to Edgar Allan Poe, one of Lovecraft's avowed inspirations, and stories such as Ligeia, in which the narrator's dead wife manages to rise again through the convenient medium of his second wife's corpse. But let me pause instead and sum up some of the things we can take away from these stories and many others like them, creating a dossier as I did for the ancient myths. First, modern stories are never of the Alcestis type. That is, the return of the dead does not end happily for all concerned. At the very least, as in some versions of Solaris, the resurrected individual longs to die once more and sometimes takes a loved one along for the ride. It's the Orpheus-Laodamia paradigm, in other words, and not a happy one. The only exception I've been able to think of is Tim Burton's Corpse Bride, which I suppose we can say ends happily, but that, after all, is the product of a mind that we expect to be playfully perverse. Following on that last point, far from implying that the return of the dead might be a special dispensation granted now and then to favorite mortals, as do the Greek stories, modern tales almost always make it abundantly clear that such a thing is against the laws of God, fate, nature, or all three. Life may be better than death, but in these stories, death is always better than anything that might straddle the boundary. Second, many of these stories offer lavish descriptions of the reanimated body's decaying state. In King's Pet Cemetery, as I mentioned, those who return from the dead carry a whiff of the grave and the marks of their wounds. One of them talks in a scratchy garble, as if she has soil in her mouth. The reanimated head in Lewis's novel must be artificially supplied with saliva before it can talk, and then it drools disgustingly into its own beard. The father makes his last wish on the monkey's paw precisely because he realizes how gruesome a sight his son's reanimated corpse will present when his wife opens the door. Every second sentence in Herbert West Reanimator includes adjectives such as ghastly, repulsive, hideous, unnatural. In the modern West, in other words, the returning dead are expected to be vile. Third, in many modern stories, the corpse is reanimated not by its own soul, but by a force of evil, a Wendigo, a colonizing space alien, or some more vaguely identified but still horrible force. At the end of Poe's story, the reader is left wondering whether the return of Lygia through the medium of her successor's corpse is an event that the narrator welcomes or not, as he watches the, quote, thing enshrouded advance boldly and palpably with mad disorder. Sometimes it is the original soul who repopulates the corpse, but with a temperament that has changed for the worse and with a hunger for living flesh. What remains of one of Herbert West's experiments, who in life was the beloved dean of the medical school, is described as strewing red death in its wake. So why are my dossiers so different? Why do the ancient Greeks express anxiety about the return of the soul, that is, the restless ghost, but not about the bodily return of the dead? Whereas modern Western culture, although certainly not immune to fear of ghosts, seems far more obsessed with thinking about the horror and danger of the reanimated corpse. We might guess that it has something to do with the advancement of technology. We might conjecture that the potential to restore life seems closer to realization now than it ever did before, and that stories like those I sketched for you are a medium through which we can think about the ramifications of that possibility. The fact that doctors and scientists are very often the reanimators in the modern stories, in King's Pet Cemetery, in Lewis's Hideous Strength, in Lem Solaris and Lovecraft's Herbert West, for example, would seem to support this. And of course, the forefather of many of these modern stories is another one, penned at the turn of the Industrial Revolution, in which another doctor meddles with the limits of life and death to his regret, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. The debt is acknowledged by Lem, who calls the space station in Solaris the Prometheus. But there's a flaw in this analysis. Asclepius, after all, was a doctor as well. The Greeks, too, were capable of using stories about the return of the dead to think about the ramifications of technology, in other words. And yet they allowed at least as many stories of the returning dead to end happily as unhappily, and never presented the reanimated corpse itself as being any problem. I would suggest that there's another and much older reason that contemporary Western culture is obsessed with the bodily return of the dead, namely Christianity and its enduring effect upon even secular representations of death. Christianity is a religion anchored in the promise that a man once rose from the dead and that those who believe in him will rise from the dead as well. One of the passages most central to the continuing importance of those claims, as we've already seen, is 1 Corinthians 15, 21 through 54, in which Paul, discussing the resurrection of the dead, promises that what is sown in corruption, that is, the body in which we die, which is buried in the earth, shall rise in incorruption, that the natural body with which we are born shall rise a spiritual body, that when the last trumpet sounds, the dead shall rise again incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible, that is, dead body, must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. In short, Paul promises that, like Christ, we will trade the bodies that we are sitting in at the moment for some better version of those bodies. Central to this passage, and especially central to the ardent debates that went on about it for more than 13 centuries among scholars and clerics, is the question of how the dead rise. With what matter of body? We heard a little bit about this earlier today from Carly. First Carly, as she ventriloquized the absent Hugo, and then Carly in her own voice. The answer pivots around how one understood the distinction between the natural bodies that we have here on Earth and the spiritual bodies that we shall have when we rise at the end of time. As Carolyn Walker Bynum showed at length in her brilliant book, The Resurrection of the Body in Western Christianity, there continued to persist a deep abiding desire that one's personal individual body be restored when the last trump sounded, even down to its moles and warts. The variety of ways in which that desire might be squared with the fact that the new body, was supposed to be better than the old one was impressive. One popular proposal was that the new body would look just like the old one and yet translucently shine with radiance. Also challenging was the assumption that the particles of each body had to reassemble themselves exactly into that same body upon resurrection. That is, not only could a person's new body not be allowed to include disintegrated particles of a bird or a fish or a beast, but Peter's body could not be allowed to include disintegrated particles of Paul's body, as some medieval debaters put it. Toes could not become noses. How did God deal with all of this and even trickier problems? What about people who had been eaten by cannibals, for example? How did God straighten that out at resurrection, the scholars asked? Hadn't some of the victim's body literally become the body of the victimizer? The history of these debates is fascinating, nor did they stop with the end point of Bynum's book, the year 1336, which simply represents the moment at which Pope Benedict XII formally declared that souls would experience beatific vision at resurrection, and therefore that souls would have eyes. Martin Luther certainly had something to say on the topic, and as far as I can tell, bodily resurrection is still doctrine, not only in the contemporary Catholic Church, but also in most forms of Protestantism, and still provocative of debate. But for all purpose, our purposes, two overall points that emerge from Bynum's book are particularly important. First, that early on, Christians developed a unified concept of the self, which valued both body and soul. Indeed, assumed that neither part of this self could be resurrected without the other, and therefore that without the resurrection of the body, the self could not be resurrected at all. This stands in contrast to a dualist concept of the self, in which self is located in the soul and the body is understood as superfluous or even as dangerously distracting to the soul. I doubt that a truly dualist concept of the soul is found anywhere outside of certain philosophical systems such as Platonism, but many peoples, including the ancient Greeks, have a modified form of it, according to which it is the soul that survives death and goes on to some sort of existence afterwards, even as the body rots. But it is a soul that has somatomorphic qualities. That is, the soul carries along with it into the afterlife certain characteristics of embodiment, such as potential sensation and an individualized appearance. This is why Odysseus is able to recognize his dead friends and relatives in the Nequia of Odyssey 11, and for that matter, why even Plato, in his own myth about the afterlife, made his souls recognizable. This was the norm in Greek thought. And this is why we're able to guess at the identities of individuals among the dead on vases, even when the painters do not provide their names. Or at the very least, we're able to discern their genders, ages, and social strata. Thus, the woman with Orpheus in the blue box is assumed to be Eurydice. The family group in the red box is thought to be initiates into the mysteries, in part because of the wreath that the father is putting on his head. And some scholars guess that the mother and sons in the green box are Megara and two of the sons of Heracles, and that the man in purple, whoever he is at least clearly meant to be foreign, given his strange hat. Greek souls are also somatomorphic insofar as they are able to suffer pain and enjoy pleasures in the afterlife. Wasn't that the whole point of being initiated into a mystery cult, after all? The second overall point that I would emphasize coming out of Bynum's book is that although Christianity insisted on the eventual bodily resurrection of every person, it acknowledged that corruption and decay of the body in which that person was born and died had first to happen. Indeed, Christianity both reviled and reveled in that decay. The rot and disarticulation of the body that followed death were understood as necessary steps on the way to eventual resurrection. If the first body didn't fall apart, you wouldn't have any raw material from which to build the second one. But these were only steps, and therefore, necessarily, decay was a sign that the process had begun but was not yet complete. This sentiment that decay is an undesirable and yet crucial stage in the perfecting of the self surely underlies two fearsome creatures who first appear in the course of the Middle Ages. One is the Revenant, whose body has begun the process of decay but has not yet finished it, who reappears amongst the living in a ghastly physical form. In other words, the reanimated corpse. Nancy Cacciola's study of such medieval revenants shows that they were traced to one of two causes. Theologians and scholars argued that it was demons who animated these rotting corpses, while the common people tended to believe it was the souls themselves, bent on returning to their former homes. Either way, such a creature was big trouble. The reanimated corpse was malicious, doing such things as raping virgins and murdering people. In other words, it is the very ancestor of the modern Western phenomena I talked about earlier, as explored by C.S. Lewis, Stephen King, and others. The other fearsome creature is the revenant whose body does not decay at all, and who does not, therefore, even enter into the process that eventually leads to resurrection. Here, too, either the lingering soul or a demonic force is understood to reanimate the corpse, eventually leading to belief in what becomes known to us as the vampire. Notably, nothing like the vampire appears in the ancient Greek imagination until well after Christianization. That is, I find no tales in ancient or even early Byzantine sources about corpses that fail to rot and return to life, just as I found none about corpses that do rot and return to life. Let me pull together what I've suggested during the past few minutes. First, Western culture, under the enduring influence of Christianity and its promise of eventual bodily resurrection, developed a stronger aversion to the rotting corpse than many pre-Christian Mediterranean cultures had developed, because the rotting corpse signified that the process of decomposition that preceded creation of the second, more spiritual resurrection body was not yet complete. A rotting corpse that was reanimated signified that either the original owner or a demon had taken improper possession of that corpse, thus interrupting the process of dissolution, reconstruction, and resurrection, either temporarily or permanently. Given that such a thing was against God's plan for the resurrection of all individuals, the reanimated corpse could only be understood as evil. The Greeks, in contrast, located the enduring self in the soul. It was in the soul that the self would experience any postmortem experience, good or bad. The corpse, although avoided as a source of contact pollution, as in most cultures, was not understood to have a continuing relationship with or effect upon the self once that corpse had been properly buried. This left open the possibility of imagining a bodily return to death in almost any way, including a positive one, as being a boon from the gods or the accomplishment of a gifted human, for example. And at this point, I want to note one more thing about the six myths that I examined at the beginning of the paper. They are so little concerned about the issue of the corpse that most of them fail to specify the origin of the body in which the returning dead makes its appearance. A possible exception is Alcestis. The fact that Heracles wrestles with death in the cemetery next to Alcestis's corpse implies that it is the corpse itself that will walk and talk again. Perhaps the same idea implicitly underlies what Asclepius did in reviving the dead. After all, physicians work on the body, but the Greeks weren't interested enough in the question to explicitly articulate an answer, and certainly neither of these stories dwells on the corpse and its qualities. Perhaps if pressed, the Greeks might have answered that it was the soul itself that rose, taking on a new solidity as it did so. Its somatomorphic qualities would have made this a logical leap of the imagination. But here, I'm just conjecturing. Two final comments. I do want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that all cultures that fear the reanimated corpse do so for the same reason that Christianity does. A zombie in the true sense of that word, for example, the corpse as reanimated by voodoo rituals originating in Africa, I mean, as opposed to the zombie as George Romero and other contemporary Western narrators have reimagined it, the zombie clearly must be anchored in a different explanatory system. The ancient Egyptians seem to have thought about reanimated corpses too, and as you know, their conceptualization of the afterlife was quite different from that of the Greeks. The Christian model was particularly apropos for what I wanted to do in this talk because of its historical situation. A Mediterranean phenomenon, it lies between the ancient Greek model of death, with which it perforce must have interacted, and the modern Western models that I initially used as contrast for the Greek model. I also do want to be clear that the model that I'm offering for understanding the ancient Greek attitude relies partially on negative arguments, which is always dangerous. Someday, we might find a papyrus or inscription that shows that the Greeks did fear the bodily return of the dead after all, although such a thing would sit very poorly alongside what else we know of the Greek views of death, as I've sketched them here. At any rate, I hope the model I've offered has at least given us something to think about, and I know that your questions and comments will push us even further. Thank you.
Well, I think we can use this question. Is it on next to it?
This has to be taken to this one.
I'm sorry, is there another question? You can get the questions on the recording.
I have my reading glasses on, so you'll have to choose for me because everyone is somewhat blurry.
Sure thing.
Hi. I have a question that's, this is just something that I've been wondering about myself, and I wonder in what sense it might fit with what you've been saying. When I think about one of the key differences between sort of modern Western life and ancient life, one of the differences I think about is the fact in which the dead and injured body is so absent from our daily experience, in that in sort of modern, rich Western countries, unless you're a nurse or a doctor, you really do not experience a dead or dying body very often, whereas in antiquity, I feel like dead and disease were much more out in the open and part of daily life. So this is just something that that I grapple with and wonder about what the consequences might be on sort of imaginations of death and resurrection. So
that's a really, really interesting and important question, and it's very complex, and a lot of good scholars have worked on it. I think I would answer very simplistically in two ways. Of course, modern cultures differ to some degree in the way that they interact with the dead body. So right now what I'm going to talk about is basically the American and Western European version, which I think is what you were referring to. I think the fact that we tend to avoid corpses and even the dying may grow partially, however distantly, out of this sketch of Christianity that I was just giving you. Somehow the takeaway, particularly as our culture has become secularized, the takeaway from those centuries of the Catholic, or not just Catholic, the Christian fear of decay and rot is, ooh, I don't even want to see that. I don't want to be associated with it. It's so much stronger than any pollution fears used to be. You know, the Greeks had a terrible fear of corpse pollution, and yet they sure interacted with the corpse. So I'm tempted to say, you know, that's where this is coming from, that even if we have become individually, some of us, completely secularized, we retain that. But my second comment would be that, of course, it is a self-feeding cycle, that the less we see corpses, the more horrified we are at the thought of seeing a corpse, and the more easily someone like Stephen King or George Romero can play with our fear of that.
Thank you very much for your talk. There's so much ground, spatially, going all the way down into the underworld. And temporally into Christianity and right up to modern times. Even that monkey's paw, I hadn't thought about that since I was a high school student, but thank you for bringing it back. You mentioned at the end of the talk, and even in the response to the last question, proper burial with the Greeks. And this theme comes up, well, even in Homer, Priam comes to get Hector's body for burial. The Antigone theme, how much of that was, as you say, perhaps some preoccupation with pollution, but how much of it might have been more a religious rite and a duty? What was the distinction, do you feel, in burial with the Greeks?
I think it's really, really hard to draw any lines there. And I also think that I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know in saying this, but religious ideas are so fluid, and you can ask someone a question one day and they'll give you one answer, and the next day they'll give you another, and by which I mean, one day you might say to a Greek, why do you bury the body so fast? And they say, well, it stinks, you know. We can't have it lying around. And the next day, that same person might be in a mood that's different and say, well, if we don't bury the body fast, the soul won't make it over the river, and the soul will return. So I think the things that you're talking about are inextricably bound together. I couldn't quite hear all of your question because there was some feedback. I think there was another part to what you were asking that I haven't...
It was just that question of pollution, the scare factor, versus just doing the religious rite, honoring the gods, and just having a proper burial, period, without worrying about what happens to the body on earth.
Right. Again, I guess I'd say they're inextricably bound together, and I would even say today that's the case. Here is where it's so easy to drift into anecdote, you know, and I could stand up here and say, well, I have a friend who's a devout Catholic, and when her mother died, and I could tell you the story of that friend and what does it really prove. But for what it's worth, I've been working on, this is a really sad statement, I suppose, but I've been working on death for the last 30 years. So I have become very acutely aware of how people react to it. And at least in Columbus, Ohio, those two things that you just pointed out really surprisingly often paired together. My friends... of course they love their parents or they love their siblings and they want to honor them by giving them the correct service of whatever kind their religion decrees. But they also still evince what the first questioner was talking about, this kind of horror of the corpse. And surprisingly often, and I think my friends tell me this because they know I do it as research, they have bad dreams about the dead, which I find really sad, that if our culture has become so kingified, that's how I sometimes think of it, the effect of Stephen King upon our view of death. If we've become so kingified that we have bad dreams about our loved ones returning, that's not good.
This microphone. I just have a question about the scene in the Odyssey, chapter 11, where the shades come back and consume this blood in order to be able to speak. And when you mentioned vampires, it reminded me of it, but it's obviously a different situation. But I'm wondering how that fits in this model of the dead coming back to life, because they're not quite there, but they're consuming this life blood. So.
Well, a lot of answering, but I swear I'm not. That's a famously fraught passage, and in fact, a whole bunch of Book 11 is, because the easy way out would be to say it's clearly got a lot of interpolations, and from what my friends who are better philologists than me say, it really does. So there is a particularly fluid approach to death in Book 11, but you can break it down into, well, this is this, and this is this. I think we are being given the message that, at least in the view of the Odyssey, the author of the Odyssey, and I do mean as opposed, for example, to the author of the Iliad, because you'd get rather different views of death in those two, the author of the Odyssey is telling us that death really sucks. There's very little picture in that book of anyone having any fun, and of course, famously, Achilles says, I'd give anything not to be dead. So part of, I think, the insubstantiality of the ghosts is in service of that picture of the underworld being terrible. Part of it may be playing with the idea that even if they have a society amongst themselves, as they seem to, since Agamemnon and Ajax don't get along even after death, Odysseus can't participate in it, which pulls at our heartstrings. In other words, I'm not giving you a very good answer because I think there's an awful lot of different things going on in Odyssey 11.
Yes, thank you. I think I have to rethink my Hippolytus paper again. But I have another very concrete question about what do you think about scenes of necromancy in antiquity? Because the model you described for modern novels and films reminds me, if it reminds me of something in antiquity, then these are the scenes of necromancy, where there is a corpse revivified and then horror is there and these things. And the second question would be, or second thought, about that in antiquity there seems one idea about the kind of power of the presence of a dead body in the case of martyr bodies, where you build your church above this present body, which is just this second phenomenon.
The first question is easier, so I'll take that first. As far as I can tell, there's only three literary scenes of necromancy in Greco-Roman antiquity, and those are Heliodorus, Apuleius, and Lucan. And two of those three are attributed to Egyptians, right? Ooh, those weird Egyptians. And the third one, namely Lucan, is attributed to a Thessalian woman, and that was notoriously the land of strange people doing strange religious rituals. So to the degree that the Greeks and Romans talk about necromancy, they're doing it relatively late, at least from the view of a classicist. For those of you who work on Christianity, it's early. But they're doing it late, and they're doing it at an arm's length. It's not something that Greeks and Romans do. And if they even try to consult one of these weird women, of course, they end up in trouble. In the magical papyri, there are spells to get a corpse to speak. And we're skating on thin ice, because it's not clear whether the corpse does anything but speak, and I'm not just trying to wiggle out here, speaking is animation after all, but I've looked so hard at those spells, there doesn't seem to be anything horrific. It's not like scenes in Stephen King or in The Monkey's Paw. It's just, apparently if you succeed, the corpse, or in some cases it's a skull, just talks. So I guess, to me, when we see the Greeks successfully interrogating the dead, it's always in the form of what they called psychagogia. In other words, once again, leading up the ghost. It's not leading up the body. It's, we want to get the ghost back to talk to us. So to me, that goes back to the division I was making early in the paper. The martyrs are a big problem, and I was talking to some of my colleagues about this recently who do Christianity, and I've begun to read some articles. It sounds to me, and here again, those of you who work on early Christianity, please tell me the truth, tell me what I should do. It's like those are set into a special little category that don't have to play by the rules, almost in the same way that you have the biblical stories of Christ raising Lazarus and who raises the widow's son, Elijah? Yeah. Well, in any case, you have people resurrecting the dead in the Bible, but I would understand those as special cases because Christ's miracles are still being performed. It's still that period when the new order is being established. Once Christ has been resurrected, you know, no one else is supposed to be doing it anymore. So I think the martyr bodies are a little bit like that. There's a special dispensation in early Christianity, but I'd love to hear anyone else say something better.
I have a few we're going to bounce around to. First of all, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you for the eloquent and interesting talk, Sarah. My question emerges out of the more Christian end of things and then goes back into the Greek and Roman, and it might not interest you, so you can take it up or not. So one of the difficulties of the interpretation of 1 Corinthians 15 is that Paul really loads on such a variety of terminology. So somata, psychika, you know, the sort of spiritual bodies, the soul bodies, all these different forms of language. And I think if we read this not in light of Paul having been a Stoic philosopher, but in light of more popularizing Stoic notions, we can say that one of the challenges of understanding the passage is that the passage may want to keep at its center a value of materiality, and that pneuma, spirit, also has a material sort of aspect to it. And all of those later, not all of them, but a lot of the later Christian interpretation really struggles with the question of the goodness of creation, the value of matter, or whether or not that has any value. When you think about the characters that you're discussing in this mythology, do you see ways in which they are revivified in later philosophical discussions that want to think about materiality and the self or the body? So that's one sort of question. Or are you willing to kind of play with this question of materiality and think about how it would impact your reading or enhance it or change it at all?
I would like to think more about materiality. And actually, as long as you've raised this passage, maybe one of you in the audience can help me with something. Let me see if I can find. I think this was partly what you were alluding to. Natural body. When I went to the Greek, the word that is being translated here as natural is psychikos. So the psychic body, and then spiritual is pneumatikos. And so, just as an aside, I don't know what the heck to do with that. Pneumatikos I understand, and that's a concept that you could take straight out of Neoplatonism or Stoicism. But why in the world the first body is being called psychikos, I don't know. And I raise that because to me it's part of this very interesting issue you raise of materiality. What interests me about the materiality of the Greek stuff, which I touched on really briefly in two places, is that they seem to have felt the only way, or I shouldn't say the only, but one of the most prominent ways that they attempted to control the soul was by instantiating it, either in a full-size statue, and that's where that creepy story of Laodamia and the statue of her husband comes in, or as these things that we tend to call voodoo dolls, even though that's not really quite what they were. But, you know, the little dolls that are sometimes buried with curse tablets that are pierced or tied or something like that. And sometimes those are meant to represent the victim, who, of course, is alive, but sometimes they're meant to represent the ghost that you're trying to get to help you. So for these reasons, I'm very interested because it seems to be the Greeks insisting on the dead have no body. And if we want to interact with them, we having bodies are going to have to invent a body by which to do so. So I don't know if that helps or not. And if again, if anyone can tell me what in the world a psychikos body is, please tell me.
Sarah, we'll just say that a lot of people don't know that.
Okay,
good. The only one. Yeah, thank you. I want to go back to you. You were speaking about in the medieval notion of the decay as a necessary part of the process toward resurrection. I wonder if you are familiar with any rituals that are designed to help the person along, to help the body along, and whether there are any stories, right, or discussions connected with people coming back, or these sort of horror at the revenants that are connected to failure of those rituals, or to not those rituals not being performed.
I don't know about cases from the medieval West. I know about cases from Byzantine Greece. Greece, for a long time, has practiced secondary burial. And so after a period of a number of years, and it varies depending on what period of time we're talking about, but let's say after 30 years sometimes it's less, you dig the body up and you clean the bones off and then you rebury the bones in another ceremony. And part of that is practical. They still do that in Switzerland today because there's very limited land for a cemetery, right? So after 30 years, you're out of there and your bones are stored somewhere else. But part of it, I mean, not necessarily in Switzerland, but I know in Byzantine Greece, and from what one of my colleagues who is Greek told me, still in rural Greece today, where they do it long before 30 years, it's to check. And if you have not finished decaying, you're either going to be counted as a vampire, because the Greeks do now believe in vampires, and you're going to be treated the way a vampire is. Or if you're kind of partially decayed, but you're not quite there, they apparently are willing to put the remains in quicklime, which will clean off the rest, and then they can rebury the bones. I don't know to what degree that's ritualized. Obviously, what you do to a vampire is a form of ritual. The quicklime, I don't know whether they pray when they do it or what. But those are the only cases I know of. I suspect there must have been others, but I don't know. That article by Nancy Cacciola that I mentioned is, so far, what I've found the most thorough treatment, and she doesn't mention anything.
Yeah, thank you for your paper. When you were talking about reactions to bodies in the modern. I was thinking of the Lazarus story, where the main concern is that the body stinks, which so it just makes me think about what's the Jewish background to say the gospel accounts and to Paul, and then going forward there is an account in Acts where Paul raises someone from the dead, and then in the apocryphal Acts this is a theme. Shows of power are the ability to raise people from the dead. And in those contexts, there seems to be no trouble after the body is raised. But the issue is before the body is raised that there's a smell. So it just makes me wonder the story about Christianity and the role of Christianity. It's a pretty complicated story, I think. And I wonder what maybe Judith or Francis or someone else could contribute in terms of the Jewish background of how you deal with bodies and smells and things of that nature. I just wonder how that gets into maybe the Christian psyche.
I'd like to know too, but I may be misremembering. I thought, in fact, Lazarus' sister kept saying to Christ, it's going to smell, and then it didn't. In other words, I thought the story turned out that actually it's sort of like Patroclus' body in the Iliad. It was miraculously...
There's no... This text is just silent.
Okay.
He's concerned it's a smell, and then he resurrects him and says, I'm buying you, I'm letting go. And then the story just ends. So we don't... There's no reference back to it later on.
I can say that in some of the early Christian iconography, Lazarus looks kind of gross. And then, so I think that concern is getting transmitted, at least in some of these, where he's not quite all put together and he's mummified in a really strange way and people are sort of recoiling. So I don't know what point of the story that's memorializing. But Judith, since we were mentioned by name, I'll take a stab and then maybe you could take a stab at. I mean, my mind goes back to the Hebrew Bible immediately and where you get very conflicting views of... there's this sort of, I think, urban myth that's out there that is in all kinds of world religions textbooks and such about ancient Judaism and how the soul and the body were one unit and they couldn't conceive of it as being separate, etc. I don't know if you've run into that, but I've run into that, and it's just so not true. Because, of course, you have the Witch of Endor raising up a soul or a spirit. I think it's the Ruach. But then you also have people who come back to life, like the person who comes back to life by touching Elisha's bones. And there doesn't seem to be any issue about it. He just comes back to life. But that's because you have this whole Eliyahu, Elisha, and I would argue in that tradition, actually, Jesus picking up on that tradition of these people who are imbued with the Ruach of God in such a powerful way that they just can do this extraordinary thing. So it is not, it is rare, but it's not rare in the lineage of the, quote, prophet like Moses. That's what I would say. But then, do you want to say something about...
That's helpful,
else or
thank you.
Maccabees, maybe?
I haven't been thinking about death for 30 years, but I will think about it a lot more in the next 30 years, I can say.
But I would only think Ezekiel 37, and again, this is of the bones coming back to life. And that's and again, this is in connection with the exile, but this becomes a paradigm. It's understood, even though it is sort of a metaphor for the return from exile. You have this vision of the reconstitution of the bones that are re-enfleshed and they get skin on them. And there's breath. I mean, this again, the Ruach is breathed in. Its divine spirit is breathed in. And this will become picked up and used and interpreted. I'm sure you all will know and could probably pick up the baton from me about how that's depicted. So I would just say that was one. And there's no smell attached, but there's certainly definitely Ruach. So that's all I would add.
Ruach means both breath and soul.
It means wind. It means physical. It's something very physical. And, again, but that's the Hebrew. And so how it's understood, it will be translated. So, I've not interpreted the different in rabbinic Judaism, how this goes in Judaism and Christianity. But
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thanks. On a different matter, I'm having some difficulty with your applying the Christian idea of an integrated self to modern times. It seems to me that we live in a fragmented culture, which is secular, it's materialistic, it doesn't look at things in an integrated form. It, in our sort of capitalistic culture as well, it tends to emphasize loss or absence, which would explain metaphorically why not having a body would be a terrible thing, but I don't see how it would, how your notion of an integrated Christian idea characterizes as modern thinking and the aversion to the decaying corpse. It seems to me it's just the opposite. It's the lack of an integrated concept that we look at the decaying body as a thing in itself rather than as part of something bigger.
Culture, in particular, is constantly betraying signs of the assumption of an integrated self. The first example that comes to my mind is a kind of silly one. It's a Walt Disney movie called Freaky Friday, where a mother and daughter, and I'm not going to even put a noun in here, a mother and daughter trade bodies and experience life as each other. And you could say a mother and daughter's souls trade bodies. Their minds trade bodies? I don't think, as far as I recall, Walt Disney specifies what exactly it is. But there's an idea that, you know, something's, that half of this is mom and half of this is daughter and vice versa. And there's various other movies and popular stories like that. A lot of them, of course, play with the idea of reincarnation. There was a movie, and this will really date me, it was when Lily Tomlin was still young, in which the soul of a dead man possesses Lily Tomlin's body and I think moves. Yeah, all of me. Yeah. So actually, I think popular contemporary culture is fascinated with that, this idea that part of you, let's call it the soul, can go somewhere else and be in a body that doesn't actually belong to you.
Yeah. Isn't there a relatively new TV series, Resurrection?
I don't watch TV, so I'm not sure, but I think I've heard about such a program.
I haven't watched that yet for a specific reason. It's based on a French television show called Les Revenants. Mm-hmm.
And right now I'm watching Les Revenants, and after I've finished that, then I want to see what the Americans did with it. From what I've seen of the clips, it looks, the American version looks terrible. It looks really, really hokey and you know, playing for emotions. The French version is horrifying. It's very powerful. And I recommend it. It's so horrifying. I mean, it really is a very well-done series, and you can get it on Netflix quite easily, the downloadable Netflix, so you don't even have to get the disc. So I will reserve my judgment on Resurrection until I see it.
Wondering about the impact of disposal rites in terms of how you might imagine a body coming back to life, with the shift between cremation and inhumation in the ancient world, but in the modern world also, having just been to the cemetery today and hearing that now 60% of the clients are cremated rather than inhumed, therefore you don't, potentially there's going to be another shift again as to how you imagine the dead coming back to life. Not as a fleshy, decaying corpse, but as something else?
Ashes.
Yeah, how do you reanimate ashes?
I've been wondering about that too, off and on. I don't have an answer. It would be great if some cultural anthropologist undertook a study and, you know, got approval from the governmental agency and all of that to really do it right, to ask whether people whose relatives are cremated think about their return. I have no idea. I've noticed, and again, this is anecdotal, it's not like I've done a study and gotten statistics, but a lot of contemporary meditations on the return of the dead that you see on TV or that you read about in books, they often occur in a hospital-like setting. In other words, where you have dead bodies that have not yet been formaldehyded or have not yet been cremated. Not all of them do, but there seems to be this particular interest in that period of time when the body has not yet been brought under control.
It's time for maybe one more.
I guess two
two comments, or a comment and a question. In danger of being overly simplistic, I've read the psychikos, pneumatikos difference as mainly an Adam and Christ difference, which is a setup of this section. And the part that's after that in the ellipsis is a Adam-Christ contrast. And so I think, again, maybe that's overly simplistic, but that's how I've read that, what's going on there. I think the spiritual body is the more confusing one to me, namely what that means for Paul. What does pneuma mean for Paul? But it seems to be a reflection on the fact that whatever the resurrected body is for Christ, it is not a resuscitated body, right? It's a new form, some new form of existence. And the canonical gospel witnesses, at least, also are working, trying to narrate that new form of existence that can both eat food and also enter locked rooms and travel very quickly between Jerusalem and Galilee. So this new body is doing new kinds of things. The second thing I wanted to ask about is getting back to Lazarus. In fact, Lazarus has not been a part of our conference really much yet, which is surprising. You could imagine that he would almost come up all the time. And I don't know if you know about this very minority view of the Gospel of John, but I'll air it today, which is the idea that this figure called the beloved disciple, who is not given a name, is possibly intended to be Lazarus, or that in some earlier version of this narrative, that person was named as Lazarus and that name went away. That's a minority view. It's a small view, but it does explain a couple things where this person appears, right? After Lazarus is raised, he doesn't appear anywhere else. What did he do? Did he go home, live with Mary and Martha, and live a nice normal life? It doesn't say. But we have this person then who appears in the Jerusalem vicinity, right, where this family lives, at the Last Supper, at the crucifixion, at the empty tomb, and then in the very last chapter of John. And at the very last chapter of John, there's a discussion about whether the beloved disciple will die. And so that generated this minority view, saying, well, why would anyone ask that question? Well, they would ask the question if it's someone who was raised, right? Then it would make sense as a question. And so what I wonder, after hearing everything you've said, is there a kind of revenant anxiety about Lazarus that was behind these beloved disciple developments?
Wow. I didn't know this theory about the beloved disciple being Lazarus, so I'm totally unprepared to answer your question.
This is my minority view. It may be crazy, but I want to hear what you think.
I don't know. I find it really, really interesting. And I guess, broadly speaking, I'd put it in the same category as a lot of the other questions we've been talking about, of is there a sort of special dispensation for things that happen around the time of the life of Christ that are different from what's going to happen afterwards? That's about the best I can do. But thank you for telling me about that. I did not know.
Sarah, I'd like to thank you for really giving us a lot of things to think about and really crystallizing a lot of what we're doing this week. This is really wonderful.
Well, thanks for your responses. They really do help. This is work in progress, and I appreciate your comments.
Thank you very much. We have a reception down in the foyer. Some wonderful Quebec cheeses. Wonderful cheeses. Let's go celebrate.